Is Easter a Christian? Today's Easter Sunday, April 7th. At least it's Easter Sunday on our calendar for 1985. And so I thought it'd be a good time to bring you an Easter sermon. And this will not be your typical Easter sermon. What I want to do is to examine this holiday and its origin and its intent and see what kind of relationship it has with biblical Christianity. Now, you probably thought, or you may have thought, that Christmas was the most controversial holiday. But in fact, Easter has a longer standing place of notoriety in the Christian church than Christmas does. Evidently, Christmas didn't become a real subject of controversy until about the 4th or 5th century. By that time, the controversy over Easter had been settled. So it was around a long time before. At least it was settled temporarily. I have a quotation here from the Encyclopedia Britannica. This is a quote from the Encyclopedia Britannica under fixing the date for celebrating Easter. Confusion early arose as to the proper date for the observance of Easter. According to the Gospels, Jesus celebrated the Passover on Thursday, whereas the priesthood observed it on Friday, the day of the crucifixion. When the church appointed Easter as a holy day, a sharp controversy ensued as to whether it should be celebrated on the 14th or the 15th of the month, the disputants being respectively called the quartodecimans and the quintodecimans. Now that means the 14s and the 15s. They argued over whether it should be on the 15th of Abib or the 15th of Abib. It's uncertain, in fact, as to whether the early Easter festivals commemorated the crucifixion of Christ or the resurrection or both. Apparently, they couldn't decide what Easter was for. Now, maybe the reason they couldn't decide that is because the confusion over what Easter meant was a problem that we don't get the full explanation of history. Early in the history of the church, a dispute arose between Jewish and Gentile Christians. The Jews, linking the festival of the death and resurrection of Christ with the traditional Jewish feast of Passover, maintained that Easter should be observed like Pesach, which is actually Passover, on the 14th of Nisan, regardless of the day of the week upon which it fell. Now that will also tell you then how the controversy concerning the Passover entered in through so-called Jewish converts. This dispute persisted into the 4th century, the Western churches generally celebrating Easter on Sunday, and the Eastern churches following the Jewish tradition. In AD 325, Constantine convened the Nicene Council, where the decision was made that Easter should be observed as it is now on the first Sunday after the full moon following the vernal equinox, to be fixed each year at Alexandria, then the center of astronomical science. Alexandria, by the way, was the Egyptian city where Christianity took on its mystical sense as it spread worldwide. So there's a lot of questionable so-called authorities about Easter back in those days, and that, of course, I believe is borne out by the confusion that ensued. So why is there so much controversy over this holiday and others like it? And I believe that it's because there have always been some Christians who have balked at the idea of incorporating these kind of things into Christian services because they consider them to come from pagan origin. Now, historians almost never report history as it actually happened. I guess you probably already know that. Historians report history as they see it themselves. It's a personal opinion of what they think happened. And so, as valuable as they are, we can't depend upon just one historian for the truth. So we are forced to read a broad section of historians' writings, and then make up our own mind as to our own opinion. And if we do that regarding Easter, then we come up with some very strange and interesting information. By the way, hasn't our society adopted some strange holidays? We have Christmas, Easter, Halloween, May Day, and others like that. Have you ever wondered where these holidays all come from and what are their purpose? And of course, if you've read Pastor Remy's book on Christmas, as Christmas Christian, you will know that Christmas came from Babylon. But what about Halloween and May Day? Have you ever wondered about May Day? Most of you know what May Day is. Christmas and May Day both are big national holidays in Russia. It just so happens. Now, they don't call them Christmas and Day. They call them Winter Solstice and Labor Day. But they observe them on approximately the same day and in the same fashion. But you know, I grew up in a little town called Dayton. And I went to a small school, and I think it was a pretty fair school as far as public schools or government schools go. I mean, most of the teachers were fairly moral there. I think they were moral people at that time, at least. And I think the atmosphere of the school and the community was pretty good. I felt fairly fortunate having gone through that as opposed to some I could have grown up in. But you know, it was a funny thing. Every year, on the 1st of May, we had a school program that where they would march us down to the city park and make us participate in a ritual called May Day. Now, none of us asked what it meant because we were so happy to get out of school that we didn't really care. And I think maybe the teachers were too. We didn't really care what it meant, but you know, we thought it was fun. And we'd usually get squirt guns and water balloons and have our own entertainment after the festivities. And we'd get to buy some bubble gum. See, we couldn't chew bubble gum in school, so we chewed it on May Day. But as far as I know, I don't think not one of us kids ever asked what that was about. What's May Day about? And I don't think any of the parents ever asked, what is May Day? As far as I know, as long as I went to that school, not one child or one parent ever said, why are we doing this? But you see, that's the way sheep are, I guess, when they get this blindness over them. But doesn't it make sense that somebody should ask, why is this? What does it mean? And why are we doing it? Are you sure we should be doing this? You know, that seems to be a good question. But no one ever asked. But anyway, we would select a May Queen, she was called. And she was selected, of course, from some of the young girls in the school. And she obviously represented something, but we didn't know what it was. And according to my research, apparently this May Queen represented a goddess of fertility. Any May Queens in the bunch? No May Queens? I should say past May Queens. Well, anyway, a certain number of couples of us children were also trained how to march into her court with music playing. Usually it was pomp and circumstance. And we'd sit around in her court, sit around the queen, and other children would dance around a phallic symbol called a maypole. You ever dance around a maypole? Well, I never did dance around a maypole, but I sat in the court a couple times. But does that sound a little bit pagan to you? Does that sound like something that public schools should be taking our Christian children through? Now, I don't know how many still do that, but I'd venture to say that in Dayton, Oregon, they still do that. In the Encyclopedia Americana, under May Day, one of the points of information has to do with our British cousins. Apparently, in the early 1600s, about the time of Britain's Civil War, it says, a severe blow was given to these merry and often wild rebels by the Puritans. Now, the Civil War was a war between the Puritans and the monarchists. Puritans were Bible-carrying warriors, you might say. They were. It was a revolution which lasted a short time. It was successful, but the success was short-lived. Anyway, it says that the Puritans, who in their companion Maypole, they had the same thing about him when he threw over the pagan altar that his father had built. The article continues to explain that the May Day celebrations were revived in Britain then after the Restoration. The Restoration is when the Puritans then lost the control and it went back to the monarchs. Let me read for you from a book titled The Golden Bough by Fraser. Page 142. The puritanical writer Philip Stubbs, in his Anatomy of Abuses, first published at London in 1583, has described with manifest disgust how they used to bring in the maypoles in the days of Good Queen Bess. His description affords us a vivid glimpse of Merry England in the olden time. Against May, this is a quote from him, against May, Whit Sunday, or other time, all the young men and maids, old men and wives, run gadding over night to the woods, groves, hills, and mountains, where they spend all night in the pleasant pastimes, and in the morning they return, bringing with them birch and branches of trees to deck their assemblies withal. And no marvel, for there is a great lord present amongst them as superintendent and lord over the pastimes and sports, namely Satan, prince of hell. But the chiefest jewel they bring from thence is their maypole, which they bring home with great veneration as thus. They have 20 or 40 yoke of oxen, even every oxen having a sweet nosegay of flowers placed on the tip of his horns, and these oxen draw home this maypole, this stinking idol, rather, which is covered all over with flowers and herbs, bound around about with strings from the top to the bottom, and sometimes painted with variable colors, with 200 or 300 men, women, and children following it with great devotion, and thus being reared up with handkerchiefs and flags hovering on the top, they straw the ground round about, bind up green boughs about to set up summer halls, bowers, and arbors hard by it. And then fall they to dance about it, like as the heathen people did at the dedication of the idols, whereof this is a perfect pattern, or rather the thing itself. I have heard it credibly reported by men of great gravity and reputation that of 40, 30, or 100 maids going to the wood overnight, there have scarcely one-third of them returned home again undefiled. So much for the maypole. So anyway, you get a glimpse of the corrupt nature of the British crown and the traditions and the rituals that they participated in. The Puritans fought for freedom from the slavery of the crown and also freedom from the idols, and then lost that freedom again before too long. In fact, they lost it almost by the time that Cromwell had died. Our forefathers fought against the crown to get their freedom here in America in the same way. They were Puritans, just like the Puritans back in England were fighting. They were fighting here. However, here, the effort was successful, at least for a little bit longer time. Nonetheless, by the time that that generation of the founders of this land, of this country here, by the time they were beginning to pass on, that freedom was going away as well. The British crown and that notorious city of London is well known for their empire around the world of control through, largely, through international bankers and secret orders like the Freemasons and other orders like that. But as I said, I think most of the teachers in my little school were probably pretty good. They were moral people, but that is a majority of them. But you can see how paganism sneaks into an unsuspecting society. More than likely, we had a few Masons on the school board there, or possibly in the faculty, or both. But that's one of the doctrines of Masonry, and that is to amalgamate cultures and religions. And it's probably to the credit of Masonry in general that we have today what's called Judeo-Christianity instead of just plain Christianity as Christ taught it. Freemasonry is a contemptible religion whose goal is to amalgamate cultures, races, religions, all into one large brotherhood of man, and all of them worshiping the god of masonry, which is man's intellect. Man's intellect is the god of masonry. Masonic doctrine has words that they use. For instance, they use the word Lucifer, and of course, superstitious Christians have said, well, that means Satan. But to Masons, Lucifer doesn't mean Satan. Lucifer is the personification of what's called Illuminism, or in other words, being illuminated or being bright. Lucifer simply means bright one or illuminated one. And so they're sometimes accused of worshiping the god of reason. Anyway, back to the subject at hand. If you had gotten up early this morning, you could have probably witnessed any number of people observing what's called Sunrise Easter service. Later on today, you could probably look around and find people, mostly youngsters, looking for eggs in the grass. These are supposed to have been left by Easter bunnies. And I personally believe that these people are doing the same thing that we did back in Dayton, Oregon, when we had our services and never asked, why are we doing this? And it just goes on and on. There seems to be no end to it. We go through the motions and we don't ask anything. We enjoy the festivities, almost afraid to question it because it might take a little bit of so-called fun out of our life. But let's look at the motives of Easter. Let's just look at the motives. We find first that the name itself is of a Babylonian goddess. Easter is a modern form of the word Astarte, or Ishtar. She was the mother god of Babylon. She was known as Isis in Egypt. She was known as the goddess Aphrodite in pagan Greece. She was known as Venus in Rome. And she was the goddess of fertility, the pagan goddess around whom all these pagan rituals were generally performed. These spring fertility rites. And they've always amounted to the same thing, and that is prostitution and sex worship. Astarte was the name given to Semiramis. Semiramis was the mother, or actually the wife, of Nimrod. She started off as his wife, and then as the legend grew about her, they began to call her his mother. Legend has it that Nimrod died and was buried and then was resurrected as a god, oddly enough. After he was so-called resurrected, he was known then as, quote, the Holy Child. And since, or his former wife, or his had become his mother by legend, took the title of the Holy Mother. So there you have the Holy Mother and the Holy Child. And all in connection with Astarte or Ishtar in Babylon. So you see, sunrise service on Easter has nothing to do with Jesus, and the mother and the child thing has nothing to do with Jesus or Mary. It has to do with Semiramis and Nimrod, or by what other name you want to call them by looking at whichever culture you want to look at. But these spring rites are designed to worship Nimrod, not Jesus. No wonder we end up with Easter bunnies, Easter eggs, and other kinds of nonsense. Bunnies and eggs are old pagan symbols of fertility. Observing Easter worship is tantamount to participating in a sex cult. In Egypt, this holy mother-child duo was called Isis and Osiris. Later in Babylon, as I said, Nimrod was the one. However, they changed his name eventually to Tammuz. So Nimrod became Tammuz, and Semiramis became Astarte. And there you have the son and the mother, and they referred to Tammuz then as the son or the seed of Astarte. Centuries later, in pagan cultures and parts of Europe, Astarte acquired the name Oster. You Germans in the crowd will know what Oster is. Am I saying that right? Is that the right pronunciation? Oster. Oster. Okay. Astarte acquired the name Oster, from which we eventually received the name Easter. It's not too difficult to figure out how the Catholics and the Protestants developed the tradition of Easter with its mother and child figures. Now, said that eventually in Babylon, Nimrod became known as Tammuz. Perhaps you've heard of Tammuz. His name is tied up with the Easter ritual directly. Actually, there is a detailed description of this connection in the Bible in Ezekiel chapter 8. If you'd like to turn there, we'll read that. Starting in verse 1. And it came to pass in the sixth year, in the sixth month, in the fifth day of the month, as I sat in mine house, and the elders of Judah set before me, that the hand of the Lord God fell there upon me. And I beheld, and lo, a likeness as the appearance of fire, from the appearance of his loins even downward, fire, and from his loins even upward, as the appearance of brightness, as the color of amber. And he put forth the form of a hand, and took me by the lock of mine head, and the Spirit lifted me up between the earth and the heaven, and brought me in the visions of God to Jerusalem, to the door of the inner gate that looketh toward the north, where was the seat of the image of jealousy, which provoketh to jealousy. Now this was something, God was going to show Ezekiel something there in Jerusalem. In other words, this would be like going to church and seeing it. This would be like going to your church and seeing this. They went to Jerusalem and saw it. The image of jealousy there, there's speculation, which makes sense to me, that the image of jealousy would be a Madonna, a statue of a mother and child. And behold, the glory of the Lord, the glory of the God of Israel was there, according to a vision that I saw in the plain. Then said he unto me, Son of man, lift up thine eyes now the way toward the north. So I lifted up mine eyes the way toward the north, and behold, northward at the gate of the altar, this image of jealousy in the entry. And he said furthermore unto me, Son of man, seest thou what they do, even the great abominations that the house of Israel committeth here, that I should go far off from my sanctuary? But turn thee yet again, and thou shalt see greater abominations. Now, I want to go on down and start reading again in verse 13. He said also unto me, Turn thee yet again, and thou shalt see greater abominations than they do. Then he brought me to the door of the gate of the Lord's house, which was toward the north, and behold, there sat women weeping for Tammuz. Well, there's old Nimrod with the other name, see? And they were weeping for him. The reason, by the way, that they weep for Tammuz is because there's a yearly or an annual celebration where they say that Tammuz dies and resurrects every year. And the way that he resurrects is that they weep for him, and that's supposed to bring him to life. Anyway, then said he unto me, Hast thou seen this, O son of man? Turn thee yet again, and thou shalt see greater abominations than these. And he brought me to the inner court of the Lord's house, and behold, at the door of the temple of the Lord, between the porch and the altar, were about 25 men, with their backs toward the temple of the Lord, and their faces toward the east, and they worshipped the sun toward the east. Well, there you have a sunrise service with the image of jealousy at a little bit different location of the same temple, worshipping the rising sun. There's your Easter service there, and God calls it an abomination. It's an interesting thing in verse 17. Then he said unto me, Hast thou seen this, O son of man? Is it a light thing to the house of Judah that they commit the abominations which they commit here? For they have filled the land with violence, and have returned to provoke me to anger, and lo, they put the branch to their nose. Now that's what some Christians do with Easter. You see, putting the branch to the nose is an old... The term came from when you were around rotten flesh or something with a bad smell. You put a branch to your nose with a good aroma, and you could stand the bad smell. And the implication here is that you can stand this bad stuff all around you if you just kind of put the branch to your nose or keep your blinders, so that you don't have to pay attention to it. Ignore it, in other words. Ignore the bad things and just let it go. That's what he says that they were doing here. And that's how idolatry gets into the church, isn't it? That's how idolatry comes in, because we ignore. We say, well, that's not all bad, it's only part bad. We'll ignore the bad part and just take the good part. That gets you into trouble every time. He goes on to say, Therefore will I also deal in fury. Mine eye shall not spare, neither will I have pity. And though they cry in mine ears with a loud voice, yet will I not hear them, as long as they do those things, I guess is what he means. So, the golden bough, also by Frazier, in chapter 29, under the myth of Adonis, speaks of a similar thing. Page 378. Nowhere, apparently, have these rites been more widely and solemnly celebrated than in the lands which border on the eastern Mediterranean, under the names of Osiris, Tammuz, Adonis, and Attis, the peoples of Egypt and Western Asia represented the yearly decay and revival of life, especially of vegetable life, which they personified as a god who annually died and rose again from the dead. In name and detail, the rites varied from place to place. In substance, they were the same. Supposed death and resurrection of this oriental deity, the god of many names, but of essentially one nature, is now to be examined. We begin with Tammuz, or Adonis. The worship of Adonis was praised by the Semitic peoples of Babylonia and Syria, and the Greeks borrowed it from them as early as the 7th century before Christ. The true name of this deity was Tammuz. The appellation of Adonis was merely the Semitic Adon, or Lord, a title of honor by which his worshippers addressed him. But the Greeks through a misunderstanding, converted the title of honor to a proper name. In the religious literature of Babylonia, Tammuz appears as a youthful spouse or lover of Ishtar, the great mother goddess, the embodiment of the reproductive energies of nature. The references to their connection with each other in myth and ritual are both fragmentary and obscure, but we gather from them that every year Tammuz was believed to die, passing away from the cheerful earth into the gloomy subterranean world, and that every year his divine mistress journeyed in quest of him. The divine mistress would have been Astarte. Journeyed in quest of him to the land from which there is no returning, to the house of darkness where death lies on door and bolt. During her absence, the passion of love ceased to operate. Men and beasts alike forgot to reproduce their kind. All life was threatened with extinction. So intimately bound up with the goddess were the sexual functions of the whole animal kingdom that without her presence they could no longer be discharged. And then it talks about the lamenting for Tammuz, which is what we read about in Ezekiel 8. In chapter 31 of the same book, The Golden Bough by Fraser, he continues to talk about the spring fertility rites. He says, in Cyprus, it appears that before marriage, all women were formally obliged by custom to prostitute themselves to strangers at the sanctuary of the goddess, the same goddess, whether she went by the name Aphrodite, Astarte, or whatnot. Similar customs prevailed in many parts of Western Asia. Whatever its motive, the practice was clearly regarded not as an orgy of lust, but as a solemn religious duty performed in the service of the great mother goddess of Western Asia, whose name varied while her type remained constant from place to place. Thus, in Babylon, every woman, whether rich or poor, had once in her life to submit to the embraces of a stranger at the temple of Mylitta, that is, of Ishtar or Astarte, and to dedicate to the goddess the wages earned by this sanctioned harlotry. Anyway, I think you get the idea of some of the connections of this infamous Astarte or Easter or Oster or however you want to pronounce their name. One of the first discoveries that you come across when you study these things in their historical aspect is that these pagan beliefs, the ancient pagan beliefs, each had their own Christ, and they still do. They each have their own anointed one. That's what Christ means, the anointed one. Approximately a year ago, I gave a series of sermons titled The Real Christ, and I was attempting to explain the fact that there are many Christs in the world, and in Matthew chapter 24, verse 24, it says, there shall arise many false Christs and false prophets, and they will go about to deceive you, even the elect if possible. In other words, what I'm saying is that we Christians have to be very strong. We have to keep our faith unadulterated. We must keep our understanding clean and uncluttered. We have to be careful that we don't confuse our biblical Christ with the heathen Christs of the world. And that means you have to know more than just his name to keep from being confused as to whose Christ you're talking about. You have to know more than just his name. An example of other Christs I want to give you here. This is a letter of information or a bulletin that was sent to us from Temple Hatikva, Israel. I'm not sure what that means, but it's a Jewish temple in Florida, Miami Beach, Florida, and it's written by a pastor, Alan B. Kurzweil. He ends it by saying this. He rails against Christ all the way through it, or Jesus, I should say. And then at the end, he says, Carol Nelson of the Beth Emanuel Fellowship said that Jesus was, in fact, a trampler of the law and a sinner in the eyes of God. He died for his own sins, and God will punish all who worship this sinner. Finally, he blasphemes Jesus here, and then he turns around and says this. Remember, we as Messianic Jews call upon all Christians to return to the religion of Jesus, Judaism. That is the only true way that Christians have true salvation and avoid a life of eternal damnation in hell. It is only through a belief in God, not in Jesus, that we can become true, completed Christians. Now here's a Jew who does not believe that Jesus was the Christ, and yet he says he can become a completed Christian. What is he saying? He's saying that Jesus wasn't the Christ, but there is another Christ. And it can only be reached through Judaism. That's their Christ. That's another Christ. That's the Christ of the world. And that's the Christ, by the way, that's taken its place in what's called Judeo-Christianity today. Okay, maybe you're wondering if the Bible says anything at all about Easter. It does. If you turn to Acts chapter 12, in verse 4, it says this about Peter. And when he had apprehended him, he put him in prison and delivered him to four quaternions of soldiers to keep him, intending after Easter to bring him forth to the people. The word Easter there, if you don't have a King James Version Bible, that word Easter probably won't be there. The King James is one of the very few who that has Easter, the word Easter there. The word is actually Pascha, which means Passover. They put Easter there because they thought maybe it was the same thing, or they wanted to change the meaning. Who knows why they put it there? The word is not Easter, it's Pascha, if you want to transliterate it to Passover. And that's the only place that Easter is mentioned in the Bible. So we have to go to other sources to know much about Easter. In the Encyclopedia Americana, under Easter customs, it says this: the English word Easter, corresponding to the German Oster, reveals Christianity's indebtedness to the Teutonic tribes of Central Europe. Christianity, when it reached the Teutons, incorporated in its celebration of the great Christian feast day many of the heathen rites and customs which accompanied their observance of the spring festival. That the festival of the resurrection occurred in the spring, that it celebrated the triumph of life over death, made it easy for the church to identify with this occasion the most joyous festival of the Teutons, held in honor of the death of winter and the birth of a new year and the return of the sun. Easter month, corresponding to our month of April and according to Bede, dedicated to Oster or Ostara, goddess of the spring, gave its name to the Christian holy day. The customs and symbols associated with the observance of Easter have ancient origins, not only in the Teutonic rites of spring, but also far back in antiquity. The practice of eating eggs on Easter Sunday and of giving them as gifts to friends or to children probably arose because in the early days of the church, eggs were forbidden food during Lent and were therefore always eaten on Easter Sunday. But the connection of the egg as a symbol of fertility and of renewed life goes back to the ancient Egyptians and Persians, who had also the custom of coloring and eating eggs during their spring festival. This ancient idea of the significance of the egg as a symbol of new life readily became the idea of the egg as a symbol of resurrection as it came to be interpreted by the Christians. The color red used in dyeing the eggs has been variously interpreted as signifying the sun, fire, the blood of Christ shed on Calvary, and the joy of Easter. In many places, Easter games played with eggs were traditional, and the annual egg rolling held on the lawn of the White House in Washington, D.C. is a modern reminder of those old-time sports. Now, that's what you call idolatry at the high level. Like the Easter egg, the Easter hare, or rabbit, now an accepted part of the traditional Easter story, came to Christianity from antiquity. The hare is associated with the moon in the legends of ancient Egypt and other peoples. It belongs to the night, since it comes out only then to feed. It is born with its eyes open, and like the moon, is the open-eyed watcher of the skies. Through the fact that the Egyptian word for hare, un, means also open and period, the hare came to be associated with the idea of periodicity, both lunar and human, and with the beginning of new life in both the young man and the young woman, and so a symbol of fertility and of the renewal of life. As such, the hare became linked with the Easter or Paschal eggs. In the United States, where the hare is unfamiliar, it is the Easter rabbit, which is fabled to lay eggs in the nest prepared for it to hide them for children to find. Now, a person can maybe say, well, we will just do away with the pagan things and keep the Christian part of it. I think that anybody who would try to do that, you'd have to be careful to keep your blinders on tight, because otherwise you would realize that, as was pointed out in Ezekiel 8, that these things are considered abominations. An abomination is the amalgamation or the attempted amalgamation of something holy with something profane. And also in Amos chapter 5, verses 20 through 27, God talks about the fact that he hated the customs that had come about in Israel. Now, the reason that he hated them was because they did the same thing there that's happening today in Christendom, and that is they mixed the heathen customs with the holy customs that had been given earlier by Moses. That's in Amos 5, verse 20 through 27. I'm not going to read that for lack of time, but he says that I hate your solemn occasions and your feasts. The reason that he hated them was because they were abominations. Well, maybe you would say, well, maybe we're just keeping the wrong day, or maybe we just have the wrong name for the day. Maybe we should just call it something else. Get rid of the word Easter. Call it something else. But there again, you're going to have to change more than the day. You're going to have to change more than the name of the day. You're going to have to change all of the things that go with it. The resurrection is one of the central points of the Christian religion. It's our hope. It's the epitome of our faith. Paul said that if we have not the hope of the resurrection, that we're totally lost. We're without hope. But I'd say that if you want to remember Christ's resurrection, there's about a million ways to do it without following pagan traditions to the letter. In fact, we do honor Christ's resurrection every Sunday to this extent. That is, Sunday is the weekly anniversary of Christ's resurrection. If you want to have an annual memorial, then I don't see anything wrong with that, but let's not mix it up with some heathen ritual and call it Christian. God doesn't like abominations, and no matter how often we throw them at him, he's not going to like them. It shouldn't be all that confusing, really. A day like that shouldn't be confused with, number one, the Lord's Supper. It shouldn't be confused with that, or communion, if you want to call it communion, because the Lord's Supper is a memorial to a death. In 1 Corinthians chapter 11, verse 26, it says, as often as you do this, you do show the Lord's death until he come. The Lord's Supper is a memorial of his death, so that doesn't fit the idea of the resurrection, per se. It shouldn't be confused with Passover, and by the way, we have to remember that Passover, the term Passover, has two definitions. One is the Passover that was given in the Old Testament, in the Old Covenant, by Moses, and the other one is the false Jewish counterfeit Passover, which is a ritual that in some ways sounds like the old, but is entirely different. But neither one of those kind of Passovers can be changed over into something called the Resurrection Memorial. And of course, Easter doesn't work, because all the things that I've been telling you, it's a spring fertility, right? That wouldn't work. And besides that, even the dating of Easter is wrong, because they date Easter from the moon cycle. So it's not dated even accurately in terms of real astronomical dating. So if you want to observe an annual memorial of Jesus' resurrection, you should at least be able to keep from getting it confused and tangled up with these things. Now, I suggest that you get you a copy of Fraser's Golden Bough. It's a book you can probably pick up in your library if you can't find one to buy. I think they have them for sale in the bookstores. You should also get a copy of a book by Alexander Hislop called The Two Babylons. Here's another quote from the Encyclopedia Americana about early America. And here again we're talking about Puritans. The religious ceremonies of Roman Catholic Church and of the Eastern Church in honor of Easter Sunday and the resurrection were always elaborate. The liturgical color for Easter was white as the sign of joy, light, and purity, and the churches and altars were adorned with best ornaments that each church possessed. In England, however, the Puritans, who abhorred the Catholic ritual and the excesses which often accompanied the observance of the church festivals, refused to celebrate Easter. Thus, at first in the U.S., with the exception of a few states such as Louisiana and Virginia, where the Puritan element was not dominant, Easter was not observed. It was not until the latter part of the 19th century, particularly during the Civil War, that the Protestant churches, other than the Lutheran and Episcopalian, began to mark this day by special services. The desire of the churches to bring consolation to those bereaved by the war made it natural for them to choose Easter Sunday with its promise of the victory of life over death and the occasion for special emphasis. The clergy preached special sermons, and the churches and their altars were decorated with a profusion of flowers. For this purpose, a Bermuda lily was used so widely that it became known as the Easter lily. As in the Roman Catholic Church, from its early days, Easter became a favorite time for baptism. The Protestant churches also followed the custom of holding sunrise services on Easter morning. The Puritan pilgrims attempted to follow the Bible. They worked at it to the best of their ability. They didn't keep Easter. They didn't keep Christmas. They didn't do a lot of the pagan things that they had learned through tradition. And for their efforts, they were blessed beyond any nation on the earth. And today, I think we've lost that Puritan spirit in America, and we've also lost our freedom. As Christians, we will no doubt make lots of mistakes. We will attempt to follow our Lord, I hope, but we will make mistakes. But let's not be blind. Let's not be intentionally blind. And let's not be insensitive. Our Lord bled and died for principle. He stood against the world by himself on principle. He was willing to go through that. He sacrificed himself to build a principle for us that we can stand on, to give us strength, to convert our hearts, to put the law in there. Let's not just callously trample over these things and decide that we can do less than he did. If we do less than he did, which we no doubt will, but when we do, let's call it less than he did. Let's not say that that it's okay with him if we do these things. Let's admit that we're stupid, or let's admit that we're lazy, or let's admit that we're making mistakes when we do those things. Let's not callously ignore these things. If it weren't important, I don't believe that my Savior would have died and done the things that he did. We have to keep our faith unspotted from the world. Hebrews chapter 12, verse 1, the writer admonishes us that, wherefore, seeing we also are encompassed about with so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which doth so easily beset us, and let us run with patience the race that is set before us, looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is set down at the right hand of the throne of God. And then in verse 28 and 29 it says, wherefore, we receiving a kingdom which cannot be moved, we may serve God acceptably, you see, serve him acceptably, with reverence and godly fear, for our God is a consuming fire. There is an acceptable service, and there is an unacceptable service. I think we should be careful as Christians to preserve it in its purity to the best of our ability. And when we fall short, by the grace of God, he will lift us up and show us where we've gone wrong. And that should be our prayers, that he will do that. Let's stand.